Wherever Jewish life has existed and flourished, it has been organized around two basic areas of concern, one local and parochial, the other the people, national. The first form of organization of life, political organization for our people, was of course the separate tribes. Each tribe was self-sufficient, self-governing. And yet they met once each year as Kalal Yisrael, as a confederation, a league of all tribes to renew the covenant with God and to make such joint plans for protection and self-defense as was deemed necessary. When under the pressure of external attack, these tribes found that they had to coalesce, and the tribal confederation gave way to a monarchy, Israel developed a centralized form of government under a king with a single capital, a single center of power in Jerusalem. Yet it never lost the sense that there must be power at the local community level. So there were always the council of elders who met at the wide space of the gates of the city, B'Sha'arei Ha'ir, and who managed the tax rolls, who managed the city government, and who dispensed justice and who proclaimed law. And when the monarchy itself disappeared under political defeat, and Israel was scattered to the four winds, and political life was again local and parochial in the sense that it was grassroots, it grew from the base, from the people, the Jews never lost the sense that they were a community. Whenever they were polituminous, self-governing militant groups within the Hellenistic, the Greek world, they still sent their half-shekel poll tax, each one of them, each year, to the upkeep of the temple in Jerusalem, where the national rites were performed, where the priests proclaimed the Torah, the law of God. And after the temple was destroyed, the scattered Jewish settlements always subscribed money to the great Babylonian and Palestinian Talmudic academies to succor and to ransom those who had been captured by pirates and by brigands on the way, to relief and to succor those who were decimated by the Crusades or by the Khmelnytsky Cossack rebellions in the 17th century whenever persecution afflicted, oppressed part of the Jewish people. We have always been a community which has been both local and national or international in its concerns and in its interests. Now, there was one attempt to create a Jewish community which was only domestic, parochial, local in its concerns. And this community grew up in America, grew up during the 19th century on these shores. The Jews who came here wanted, of course, to escape from the persecutions of Europe. Many of them felt that they were persecuted because Europeans continued to look upon them as members of a corporate community, members of the ghetto, members of a kahila, which would be always self-governing, identifiable. So they brought here a desire to blend into the landscape, to lose the sense of corporateness, of national responsibility, and to simply become what all other Americans seem to be, Americans who had one or another religious denominational affiliation. Yes, they reestablished in the 19th century in America many of the institutions which had been known in the Jewish communities of Europe. There were Jewish hospitals, and there were Jewish orphanages, and there were Jewish social agencies. But I suspect that we have overdrawn and overemphasized in our histories the continuity of the tradition, and have forgotten that when these Jews came to America, they found here a religiously based community which had already established a St. Vincent's Charity Hospital, a St. Luke's Hospital. Religious organizations had long since undertaken to do the social welfare, the medical, the healing, the educational work of America. So when the Jews came and established at a local level these institutions, they were not only maintaining their traditions of community concern, but they were acting as all other Americans acted. That is, they were performing acts of local service under religious auspices, because that was the way in which America was organized. But above all else, many of them wanted to avoid the label of community, avoid a sense of corporate responsibility for the destiny, the survival of Jews everywhere and elsewhere. This was the heyday of isolationism in America. And when Jews in a Cleveland came together to organize some central agency, they were very careful, and Cleveland was no different than any other city. They were very careful not to establish a Jewish community. Rather, they established an association of Jewish philanthropies or an association of Jewish charities. The urge to organize was not the urge to establish community with political parameters and political concerns, but rather it was the urge to take a series of financial obligations and to simply unify them so that there would be one campaign, so that there would be one agency through which the monies would be raised for all the institutions which then existed at a local level. And it really wasn't until the 1940s and the 1950s that most of these associations of Jewish philanthropies grew into something more. And again, during this early period, the Jews were simply taking on the characteristics of the larger American society. For Americans generally had come to these shores to put an ocean between them and the class wars and the religious and racial prejudices of Europe. They wanted to leave Europe behind. It represented an anchor around their neck. It represented the danger from which they had escaped. Isolationism was the order of the day. Populism was the native American political reaction. Let's solve our own problems and the rest of the world, in a sense, be damned. We'll create here the kingdom of God on earth. Now, when America broke with its isolationist past, it never forgave Woodrow Wilson for plunging us into the First World War. And it took out its anger on Wilson for this act by denying to him the one hope which existed at the end of the First World War for some kind of international community when it refused to ratify the Treaty of the League of Nations, which was in a sense the statement, America again returns to its landlocked island base between the oceans. Let Europe, let Asia take care of its own. Our problems are here and these are our only problems. And long into the 30s, Senators Borah and Wheeler and others, as you remember, were fighting the lending of destroyers to England, lend-lease to the Allies, insisting that America stay out of the European convulsions. These were none of our business. Now, of course, Hitler, Stalin, the whole works of the 1930s forced us into these international concerns. And we emerged from the Second World War the greatest power in the world, and the world had shrunk. We had sent our armies across two oceans, and we recognized how close the lands of Asia and Africa and Europe really were to these shores. And after the Second World War, we embarked on international experiences of many kinds, on the Marshall Plan, on NATO, on the United Nations, on foreign aid. We were eager to involve ourselves throughout the world. And this is the period in which, in the American Jewish community, there is a reflex of this international concern, more desperate, more urgent perhaps, but nevertheless one which we must see in the larger terms. There had been Hitler, there had been Stalin, there was Auschwitz, and there was Israel, and there was Soviet anti-Semitism, and the American Jewish community began to plunge ahead to organize succor and relief and upbuilding and state-making and all of the things with which all of us are familiar. And we did so in an atmosphere which was conducive to these kinds of involvements. And all of a sudden, associations of Jewish philanthropies became Jewish community federations. It became obvious to Jews that it was necessary that we undertake a series of communal responsibilities for those political and social responsibilities which deal with Jewish survival. And so during the 40s and the 50s, a series of what were essentially self serving agencies, agencies which had a single focus, which had existed outside community structure, to, because many Jews at all times recognized the peopleness, the sense of the larger responsibility. Zionist groups, immigrant relief groups, new American naturalization groups, defense agencies, community relations councils, groups that were concerned with a Jewish stance on federal aid to education and fair employment practices commissions, all kinds of domestic all of these concerns were more or less brought together and brought in under the aegis of something which came to be called a Jewish Community Federation, or a Jewish community. And the larger world confirmed what the Jews were doing. This was the age of cultural and ethnic pluralism. This was the age in which America lost its feeling that all individuals would blend through the melting pot into some homogeneous single structure and single form, and recognized that we would be dealing with a country which would have a series of cultural and ethnic and racial minorities, and that each one would in its own way develop its own political, cultural, and social structure. Now, all this is past history, and I've drawn it to emphasize how the changes which have taken place in American Jewish life have been not simply changes which are natural, but have been changes which have been brought about by the fact that we take on the coloration of the community, the politics, the social considerations of the world in which we live. Because it seems to me that now that the 1970s have begun, now that America has moved away from many of its international preoccupations, now that a mood of neo-isolationism has begun to spread throughout the land, this whole concept of Jewish community is going to be threatened by a series of assumptions and axioms which we ought to understand. And all of us are going to have to recognize that we are going to be able to maintain an effective Jewish community only if we understand its purposes, its priorities, and its place in the national scheme of things. Vietnam represents not only a stupid political and military miscalculation, but proof positive to most Americans that America did not know what it was doing in most of its international undertakings, that instead of seeking peace, it was seeking imperial preference and trade advantage. And the result was the loss of tens of thousands of American lives and hundreds of thousands of Asian lives, a carnage of bloodshed which had no rhyme, reason, or purpose. And around the peace movement, around the movement to disengage ourselves from Vietnam, there has arisen a whole spirit, a whole mood in America to disengage ourselves from other international commitments as well. Why not? The rationale is clear. There are problems in America, growing problems, problems of urban living, problems of safety and law and order and justice, problems of race, problems of poverty, problems of insufficiency at all levels of social concern. And it seems natural and understandable to most Americans that our so-called foreign aid, our so-called international obligations, were simply a cover-up for a variety of selfish interests, and that far better this money should be brought home and used here for our immediate and private domestic problems. And so the movement to get out of Vietnam is not only a political movement with a single specific end and purpose, but it is a much broader movement which insists on a total reordering of American domestic and international priorities. Now, the way of wisdom, it would seem to me, is not to say either or, either foreign aid or the war on poverty. Either we cut all of our international obligations or we cannot wage war on the injustices which are rampant in our center city, or the class structure which still exists between the privileged and the unprivileged, the white and the minorities in our society. But to say both and, that there are necessary and required international obligations we cannot simply abandon. There are small countries and larger countries which are democracies which do need our support and our leverage. And there are obviously urgent and vital domestic issues which we haven't begun to confront with the money or the manpower or the skill or the urgency which they require. But it's not an either or, it's a both and. But whatever the answer that we come to as to the reordering of our national priorities, the tide of neo-isolationism exists in our country, and it's becoming a riptide. It's becoming more powerful day by day. And it seems to me it is inevitable that it has a certain spillover on the whole structure and the whole future of what we call the American Jewish community. Because if we haven't seen as yet the call to withdraw our support from international Jewish obligations, the upbuilding of Israel, the settlement of the immigrants, the freeing of the Jews from the kind of tyrannical oppression that they're under in the Soviet Union. It's simply because these problems are so visible and so immediate and so urgent. But all of the forces exist below the surface, which I think will spill over if there is ever a moment of quiet and peace, and make it very difficult for us to maintain a Jewish communal structure unless we understand it and are committed to it. There are still those Jews from the middle class and the upper middle class whose commitment to the Jewish community is not a commitment to Amcha, to this people, Israel, wherever it exists, but essentially a commitment to a single institution, a parochial school, a hospital, a home for the aged. That's where their interests are, and their interests are limited to the needs of that particular institution. They've been willing to go along with the larger needs because under the guise of the urgency of the international need, fundraising has multiplied to an incredible extent. And all of the individual agencies have received more money than they could ever have received if they had not been sponsored by a fundraising drive whose basic purpose was for Israel, was to permit Jews throughout the world to find life and health and some measure of decency. But these Jews still exist here and there. They tend to be Jews of some wealth and therefore of some economic clout in the fiscal oligarchy, which is still the board structure of most Jewish communal institutions. But more significant and more than these few Jews, who are essentially holdovers from the patterns of the 1920s and the 1930s, is the existence of a whole new group, a group of young people, of the not so rich, whose whole heart and soul has been involved in the social struggles of this 1960s in America, in the peace movement, in the civil rights movement, in the ecological movement, and all of those movements which tried to come to grips with the obvious and immediate urgent needs of an American community. This has engaged them. And they find it difficult to understand why Jews do so much for something which exists way out there when they claim they do so little for what the problems which exist right next door. Well, the judgment isn't necessarily so. There's no obvious dichotomy between Jewish leadership in movements for the benefit of Cleveland as Cleveland and Jewish leadership in movements for benefit of the Jews throughout the world, the succor of the Jews and their reestablishment and decency in Israel. As a matter of fact, the leadership has tended to be similar. But there is a gap. There is a gap of misunderstanding, of non-familiarity between these Jews. They tend to be younger, they tend to be better educated, they tend to be more willing to be involved in demonstration and confrontation, and the more established Jew who works through the existing Jewish organizations and existing Jewish communal institutions. And this gap is a dangerous one for the future of American Judaism, because it is a gap which has each looks upon the other with a built-in misunderstanding. This is the establishment. This is therefore self-seeking, conservative, interested only in its own priorities. And this establishment looks down upon the undergroup and sees only young people and the not so young who are willing to involve themselves prophetically in every other cause but the causes which seem to immediately involve Jewish life. Now, obviously, when such a gap exists, the first and most urgent need is for a program of education and commitment, of understanding of what a Jewish community is all about and why it exists. It exists in a free society not to be a nation, a self-defined polity which limits our interests and our loyalties, but it exists in a cultural pluralistic society in order to take care of a series of responsibilities which are unique to the group which it represents. It obviously includes people who are vitally concerned with all other issues. But as America is now constituted, no man can defend his own rights alone. He needs the support of a group. He needs the support of some body which will stand up and make clear his needs, his responsibilities. And so the Jewish community's first obligation must be to its own. It doesn't mean that the obligation of Jews are only to their own, or that the leadership or fellowship of in a Jewish community is limited in its obligations to simply Jewish causes. It means that the immediate purpose of a Jewish communal structure is to take care of Jewish community needs. No one else will do it. Now, when Jews fail to look after their own, there is tragedy. I give you the experience of many of the very poor among the Jews of New York and of Philadelphia and of Boston, who in the last 3 or 4 or 5 years have found themselves caught between national Jewish organizations composed largely of upper middle class people who lived in the suburbs, who could be radically concerned with social change because they had nothing to lose from social change in their cities, who allied themselves with all the forces of radical social change, and forgot that caught between the two millstones, there were a group of Jews who were teachers in the New York public school system who had invested 20, 22, 25 years in their profession, who simply couldn't throw up their tenure, their pension, because they were no longer wanted. That in Queens and in the Brooklyn and in the Bronx, there were pockets of poor Jews on the welfare rolls who would not get their share unless they had some voice in the councils of welfare, who simply couldn't be abandoned. The cause of the Jewish poor, however, was too often overlooked by our national Jewish agencies because they had forgotten that however much we, all of us, must be ultimately concerned with all of the problems, as national or local Jewish organizations, we have a first responsibility to take care of our own. Charity begins at home. Your first responsibility as parents is to your children, then to your family, and then to the larger community of which you're a part. Now, that doesn't mean at all that Jews ought to withdraw support from any and all organizations which they feel do good, will bring about what the urgently needed changes in our society. Not at all. It simply means that the first concern of a Jewish community must be at home and with its own. And that's its purpose. Otherwise, we could affiliate ourselves with any number of political and social agencies which are not at all ethnic, religious in base, and achieve the same purposes. Now, if we're going to understand this as a basic focus for Jewish community undertaking, then obviously we're going to have to do a far better job than we do now with our young and with our educated and with our not so young to make them understand the purposes and the significance of Jewish survival, the survival of Jews as Jews. Here and there when I talk to young people, fine, sensitive young people, I find them saying to me, "But why should I be involved? What is Israel to me? My life is here. My concerns are the concerns of my community. Israel is just another state in the world. Oh yes, if Israel were some kind of pure white country, that is purely white in the sense of saintliness, I might be involved with it. And there are in Israel social experiments like the kibbutzim, which I approve of, but Israel has an army. And somehow today, a country which has an army is a country which is suspect, because we're all for peace. The bumper in my car says, another family for peace. What is Israel to me and I to Israel? Well, somehow with these young people, we have failed. We have given them a sense of the moral teachings of our prophets to establish justice and peace, family between all the races of the world. But we have not made them understand that if they simply rush out like Don Quixote's to do that which is good and neglect the institutions and the community which raise them to understand this level of ethical responsibility, we are neglecting the next generation, and we are fundamentally misunderstanding the nature of American life. Because whatever America will be, one thing is clear. Unless you are tied in to some communal base, unless there is a group that speaks for your interests, not only the economic interests of the business world of which you're a part, or the professional group of which you're a member, but the private interests of the religious or ethnic or cultural group which you belong to, with which you are affiliated, no one will stand for you. And you will find that as decisions are made by government, these decisions will be made on the basis of pressure, of politics. Policy is only the rationalization and the justification of the adjustments which people demand of their government. That more and more your position, position of Jews or of any other minority, will be weakened, because we will be attempting to do the impossible, to insist that we are only individuals, we are only non-ethnic, non-minority, non-identifiable single integers, and that it is as this that we must be appreciated and provided for by government. We've long since passed that point in our national history. A country of 210 million of people, which will be 300 million in a decade or so, will not be a country in which the individual can work as a unit unto himself to secure all the rights which he needs. He will have to ally himself in a number of ways. And to protect these loyalties, these interests, he will have to identify himself with the ways in which Americans generally have identified themselves, religiously, ethnically, or as members of racial or immigrant minority groups. Now, I find nothing difficult to accept in this kind of image. Jews have lived for 2,000 years or more as members of millet communities. That is, as members of communities which were part of larger structures, communities which had no ultimate political power, only the power which was vested in their effectiveness, in the amount of personal commitment which was involved, in the creativeness and the capacity of the individuals who were part of that community. Taking care of many of their own responsibilities, having institutions which serve the needs of their people, and reaching out, and this is important, and reaching out beyond that which serves one's own immediate needs in two ways. First, to support, to sustain Jewish life wherever it exists. And secondly, to support and to encourage life in the larger community of which we are a part. Let nothing I say here this morning encourage you to believe that Jews can be any less vigorous in their actions in behalf of a better Cleveland or a better America. that we can pull back and withdraw from the problems of race or the problems of peace or the problems of privilege and poverty which exist in our society. That's not at all what I am saying. We need to do far more, not far less. But much of what we do in these areas cannot be done through peculiarly Jewish institutions. It must be done through other kinds of structures, political and otherwise. And we must not impose upon our Jewish community that kind of responsibility in a major way, because it doesn't have the capacity and the power to carry it out. It exists because Jewish life requires its existence, because Jewish life is threatened in many places of the world, because there are jobs that we must do to create a climate of opinion which will understand and appreciate all that Israel represents, to create a climate of opinion which will help us to succor the Jews of the Soviet who live in daily terror, to create a climate of opinion which will help us to close the gap between those who are committed and understand the peopleness, amcha, the klal, all that is Israel, and those whose hearts and whose immediate experience have helped them to understand only the larger issues, to help young Jews understand Judaism, the Jewish people, to help the Jewish people understand the pressures which lead the young and the not so young to be more radically involved in the community than the past generation may have been. The 1970s, dear friends, will not be an easy age for the American Jewish community. We have had until now a correspondence between the world without and the world within. We've been able to take the conventional wisdom of the larger world and essentially use it to justify the inevitable thrust of American Jewish development. But now, America, the needs of America, the conventional wisdom of America, and our needs may begin to diverge, to move apart. America was supportive of Israel because Israel represented a small nation, a democratic nation, a radically innovative social experiment, the small facing those that are contemptuous of anything but might, and because guilt was involved, the guilt of Dachau and Auschwitz. But now Israel, though objectively it continues to represent all of these values, represents also an international obligation or commitment. And there is something in America moving against this kind of involvement. We don't want to be pulled into foreign wars. And the same is true of our concerns with Soviet Jews. We read the Soviet through the Riga trial and the Leningrad trial and all that, the suppression of any kind of dissent. America is beginning to read the Soviet in terms of the possibility of some kind of high-level international understanding, the SALT talks, trade agreements, some kind of way of containing the newly emerged power of China. And so our urgency to succor runs to a certain degree against the desire of the State Department to soft pedal and to play down. And when a representative of the State Department goes before a congressional committee, as he did 2 weeks ago, to make a statement on the condition of the Jews in the Soviet Union, he finds every adjective he can to indicate that the problem is not quite as desperate, as urgent as American Jews have tried to picture it to be. Now, when the nation's mood begins to diverge from some of the priorities and the needs of the Jewish group as such, it's going to take a degree of understanding and a degree of commitment on our part to hold fast to what we know to be our responsibilities to our families and to our own, our religious and social level. And that's the challenge which we're going to face. And it's a challenge which is going to demand understanding and perception. It's a challenge which is going to demand patience and tolerance. It's a challenge which is going to demand a restructuring of our Jewish communities as they now exist, because they do tend to be simply class structures where power rests with the big giver, and where there has been not enough effort to reach down and to close the gap between those who have the substance and those who have the will, the talent, ability, but cannot give the large gift. There are going to have to be all kinds of internal restructurings. But more than this, somehow we're going to have to make it clear to Jews, to our own Jews, that is to our own children, that is to ourselves, that Judaism is not simply a Sabbath hour of worship, not simply the lighting of candles one day a week, not simply a teaching of 10 commandments which are shared in one way or another with the great religious traditions of the West, but that the Judaism is coeval with the people, with what we call Israel, the larger Israel, and that the survival of this people is a primary ethical, moral obligation upon us, its survival and dignity. That somehow the survival of Israel is part of God's ultimate plan. For out of Zion shall go forth the law, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. That our existence as catalytic agents within every society of which we've been a part has made for the betterment of that society. And that we have a responsibility to maintain our integrity and our spiritual uniqueness. It will not be easy. The challenges will be many. There are going to be some sunshine soldiers and summer patriots who are going to disappear from our midst. But I'm fully convinced that during the 70s, the sense of Jewish community will be solidified, deepened. That we will meet these challenges somehow and emerge with a better and clearer understanding of our responsibilities to ourselves and our responsibilities to the larger world. Amen.